Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the health care they need. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. Today on our show, we learn why some students struggle just to get to school, and we go on a tour of Tulare, where citizens are taking environmental justice into their own hands. I'm Laura Satsui.
And I'm Alice Daniel. We also hear from some advocates who are rallying community members to build their own parks in a city where access and upkeep is lacking.
But first, a recap of this week's news. Mojave Desert communities in Kern and San Bernardino counties are still assessing damage from two destructive earthquakes over the Independence Day weekend. On Tuesday night, Ridgecrest officials, along with Congressman Kevin McCarthy and other lawmakers, hosted a free movie night to bring the community together and lift spirits. In contrast to more serious press conferences, Ridgecrest Police Chief Jed McLaughlin went live on Facebook just before the movie started.
Hurry up, there's still hot dogs, there's still a lot of food, so come down and enjoy what we have going on down here.
As of yesterday, the Red Cross confirmed 71 people are staying at its emergency shelter, 16 of whom are still sleeping outside in the parking lot. The Naval Weapons Base at China Lake also remains evacuated, except for essential personnel.
Also this week, Vice President Mike Pence visited the San Joaquin Valley for a fundraiser luncheon and a talk about the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA. It's the president's replacement deal to NAFTA.
The president asked me to be here today for one reason and one reason only. I think you farmers that are gathered here today know it, and all of you in the San Joaquin Valley understand it. California and America need Congress to pass the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, and we need them to pass it this year.
Building off of NAFTA, the deal would increase access to the Canadian dairy market and create provisions over the use of biotechnology.
A well-known Mono Indian tribal elder, Galen Dennis Lee, was shot to death near his home in North Fork Saturday night. The suspect, Robert Eugene Moy, Jr., is in custody and has been charged with first-degree murder. Deputies searched his home and found a marijuana grow and butane oil lab. Lee's nephew, Mike Lee, says his uncle, an author and historian, taught the younger generations about the Mono language and culture.
There's a lot of people that have been coming up and saying, by talking with him and him giving them some of our culture and beliefs, has helped them through some of their hard times. So that's what I'm using to help me and my family through this time.
After filing lawsuits against the state, more than 100 current and former inmates who contracted Valley Fever while in state prison are now petitioning the U.S. Supreme Court. They're asking the justices to review a lower court's decision to reject an earlier lawsuit. Lead attorney Benjamin Pavone argues the Department of Corrections failed to protect more vulnerable inmates from the disease.
If you have a nuclear meltdown, you go into a whole mode of precautions, and they just didn't do anything.
The Supreme Court will decide whether to review the case in October.
And some good news. The Fresno County Sheriff's deputy, injured in a shooting and tense standoff last week, was released from the hospital yesterday. The suspect in the shooting, who's facing two counts of attempted murder and a $2.5 million bond, pleaded not guilty earlier this week and is set to reappear in court later today.
Listen for more FM 89 news every weekday during Morning Edition and All Things Considered. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. The California dream used to be a car and a house. But for some people today, the dream is a car that is your house. They call it van life. As part of the California Dream Collaboration, Capital Public Radio's Sammy Kaola goes in search of the van life community.
Is it open? Oh, really hard.
So I hop in with this guy. He goes by the name Travis Wild. We're in his shiny navy blue Dodge.
Yeah, so this is a bumpy road. Like, this looks like a cool spot that I get back into. potentially.
He's been living in this van for about 3 years. He's constantly looking for a new campsite to call home. Tonight, he rolls up on a rocky bank near the South Yuba River and lets his dog out.
She's got a lot of energy to get out. It was probably a little less than 7 hours of driving to get here.
People in the van life share a big dream of living small and going places. It's taking off in California, where rising housing costs and a sense of adventure are inspiring more and more people to go wheels only. The first thing I notice about the inside of Travis's van is how comfortable and clean it is.
It's pretty simple.
His walls are pine, the floor is bamboo, his bed is surrounded by bookshelves, and a surfboard hangs from the ceiling. He shows me some space-saving tricks, like this hidden table that slides out.
From right here. Just from under the bed.
Whoa.
And then continuing, just all of this is storage on the sides.
Travis is part of a community that's choosing the nomadic lifestyle. To save on rent, to live greener, or just because it seems like fun. But there's a whole other set of people who are forced to live in their vehicles because they can't afford housing. Sometimes these two groups join forces to fight local bans on sleeping in cars. Those are popping up in places like San Diego and Berkeley as more people go mobile. Voluntary van dwellers say they know it's a privilege, but it's not always easy. Vehicle maintenance, internet shortages, and even finding a place to use the bathroom can be a struggle.
There's always like these little kinks that are, at first it's like, oh, this is part of the adventure. And then you're like, oh, this is like, it's rainy, and I have to stay inside here a little bit more than I would have liked to.
None of this stops van lifers from doing their thing. Gabrielle Lewine is a grad student in psychology at the University of Southern California. She's researched millennials, their hopes and goals. She says some are rebelling against their parents' dreams.
Millennials are just questioning whether that's worth it. You know, it's a very traditional thing to think about. The primary thing you need is a roof over your head. In the same way that millennials are, to use the very trendy word of disrupting other kind of marketplaces, non-traditional living situations is, I think, just another piece of that trend.
Van dwellers tend to work remotely. They're artists, accountants, and web developers. The lifestyle is even generating its own microeconomy. Some travelers become social media influencers who make money by tagging gear companies on Instagram. Others run van life websites and apps. I stopped by to see Josh Thompson. He's converting a van into a mobile home right now. Country music plays as he measures out space for cabinets and other furniture.
So the bed will be up here, and this will be like kind of storage area for extra bike space, and then also just like climbing gear and whatnot.
He's getting pretty good at building these. Sometimes he sells the vans, but he's keeping this one for himself.
Like, life's pretty short, you know? It's just a minimal living that allows you like the freedom to make choices of what you do with your time and what you do with your money.
Travis says the same thing, that it's about freedom. That and the people he meets on the road.
It actually allows like face-to-face interactions, which are really important and becoming less and less common in today's world, I guess, is a big thing. Like, you can chat online all you want, but like, you'll really get to know somebody if you like, you know, have a couple beers around a campfire and go on a hike and like that sort of thing. That's really the fun part.
I say goodbye as Travis starts boiling noodles on his countertop stove.
So we'll get that going.
I notice a plank above the door, scribbled with a dozen signatures from friends who have stood right here. But tomorrow, like hundreds of other California vagabonds, he'll set out alone. In Yuba City, I'm Sammy Kayola.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. Skipping school, cutting class, senior ditch day. Some consider truancy a part of adolescence. But looking at the data, one reporter found that students in rural regions have a much higher risk of being chronically absent from school. And the reasons aren't so simple. I spoke to David Washburn about reporting these stories for the online publication EdSource. He's now the news and investigations editor at KPBS in San Diego. He started by explaining what chronically absent means.
I mean, chronic absenteeism is defined by the state of California as a child missing 18 days of school in a given school year. Statewide, the chronic absenteeism rate is just over 11%.
Okay. And so your series specifically delved into rural areas where that rate tends to be a lot higher than in urban regions. Can you tell us, where did you go and what kind of stories did you happen to find?
We did an analysis of absenteeism rates across the state and found that in rural areas, especially in the northern part of the state, in the Sierras, northern coastal areas, that the rates were significantly higher than the state average. And one place we concentrated on was Butte County, which is home to Paradise, where the devastating campfire struck last year. We found that a variety of things were causing the absenteeism. One is, as you would expect, just isolation. You know, you have these mountain communities that have, you know, 30, 40, up to an hour bus rides into school. If you miss the bus, you know, you're not going to school that day. And a lot of it has to do with the socioeconomics of the area. You know, families might not have, you know, more than one car, and mom and dad need the car for work. So if the kids miss the bus, then they're home from school that day. We also found, you know, a lot of issues in, you know, Butte County that you might have thought of being, you know, issues in, you know, inner city urban areas, but you're finding a lot of the manufacturing base has been depleted in these rural areas, and so you have high unemployment, you have high rates of drug abuse, alcohol abuse, and so you just have a lot of dysfunctional families. You know, a lot of people living on the margins, which of course affects the ability of kids to make it to school.
Right, so maybe the problems you might expect to see sort of in any community, but compounded in these more rural areas, I suppose.
Right, compounded in these areas also because you don't have the same level of resources as you do perhaps, you know, in a place like Oakland, where you're going to have a lot of similar issues, but you're not going to have the level of resources or the ability to reach the families because, again, they're so isolated.
These seem like bigger structural issues, poverty, you know, a lack of a transportation system, people, you know, literally living far away from where school is. I want to get into that a little bit later, but you reported that states only recently started tracking all of these absenteeism, you know, including not just truancy, but sickness and things like that. They only recently started tracking that in 2016. Why weren't they tracking it before?
Absenteeism, when it comes, you know, has been looked at through the truancy lens for most of history. And, you know, and it's been treated, quite frankly, like a legal issue more than a public health issue. And, you know, so they would, you know, truancy meaning skipping school, kids that are unexcused from school. And it just, you know, over the years, it became apparent that, you know, you're really not getting the entire population of students who are, you know, who are missing out on school if you just focus on truancy. This organization, it's based in the Bay Area, but it's a nationwide organization called Attendance Works, led by Hetty Chang. Really, over the, you know, starting in the beginning of this decade, really pushed school districts and the state to start recognizing chronic absenteeism as being more than just truancy. That includes students that are, you know, excused absence, and also importantly, students that are absent due to suspension and expulsion.
And so how are the schools that you were looking at trying to tackle this? I know you mentioned in Paradise Unified, one solution was like this trauma-informed approach. Can you talk about that? And I guess, how was it working?
The trauma-informed approach is an approach that is really gaining a lot of traction everywhere. But what that is just being able to understand where the students are coming from and, you know, how are they showing up to school and what are their home life situation? What are the community, what's their community environment like? So having a better understanding of that when kids come to school, not only for absenteeism, but also just for behavior, you know, why is a, instead of saying, you know, what's wrong with you when you come to school, when you don't come to school or misbehave in school, the questions are, you know, what's happened to you? You know, what is your circumstance? And having that approach and asking those questions has helped to for educators to understand what is going on at home, and then maybe having interventions that can help, you know, perhaps alleviate the situation at home, or at least get a better understanding of what's happening. I mean, it's a difficult issue for schools because there's so much when it comes to absenteeism that is out of their control. So, you know, they can't control the home life of a child. They can't control, you know, what the circumstances might be with the parents. But what they can do is improve their school environments, create better lines of communication with families and communities, so there is more of a welcoming environment in school. You know, a lot of this has to do with this kind of zero tolerance discipline policies, you know, that kind of came into being more in the kind of the late 80s and 90s when there was really this crackdown. There was this spike in youth crime, and there was this idea that we need to have zero tolerance, both in juvenile justice and in schools. And so that, you know, created disconnects with families. And so they are kind of trying to reverse those trends. You know, and then a lot of it is some of the basics, you know, trying to work to, you know, find ways to help with the transportation issues and mental health. You know, if you're not coming to school due to mental health issues, having more counselors, having more school psychologists on hand.
Getting back to talking a little bit more about the issues of, you know, poverty and isolation, those are like, I feel like absenteeism is sort of like this manifestation of what can happen when all of, as we mentioned, those problems exist in a certain area. Are people looking at absenteeism and then saying we need to address these bigger things and coming up with ways to address those bigger things? Or is that sort of too big in some minds to get to?
I mean, I don't want to say that other issues, you know, graduation rates or improving test scores or things like that are difficult. But this is, again, difficult because you don't have control over the home environment. You don't have control over the community environment. But there is another thing that they're trying to do is just create better incentives. And, you know, there are a lot of families in places like the Sierras and northern coastal areas that they don't have a connection with institutions. They don't. They feel like their government has let them down. They feel like the school system has let them down. They feel like that they are not welcome. And so there is this just kind of intergenerational, it has to do with intergenerational poverty and attitudes that are like, we're off the grid. We don't want to have anything to do with, you know, institutions because our experiences with them have usually been negative.
And more in your reporting, you talk about, you know, socioeconomics of the people who are in these communities. I mean, where are their livelihoods? What are they doing to survive?
Historically, these regions were supported by, you know, largely the timber industry. And that industry, among others, has been in decline for decades now. And a lot of these small manufacturing hubs, timber producing regions have, you know, they've lost a lot of that. These families have lost their livelihood because because of the decline of the industry, and they've turned to, in a lot of marijuana cultivation is something that a lot of these families have turned to. This, of course, we have legalization in the last couple of years, but we still have a very large black market, and you have families that their livelihood comes from the marijuana industry, and they are literally off the grid and don't want to have anything to do with the school system or the, you know, the criminal justice system because they, for obvious reasons. And so that is another area that is, you know, another difficult hurdle for schools when it comes to finding these students and getting them to school.
We can't ignore, I think, how the campfire has also impacted these communities. You reported this series after the campfire happened, but the data you were drawing on was from before it happened. And so after the campfire, was there anything that came in that changed absenteeism as well? I'm sure students were more absent because of all the problems from the fire, but can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, sure. The fire, of course, had a tremendous impact. We don't, the fire hit in November of 2018. And the absenteeism data is not out yet for that. So it won't be until, I think, the end of this year that we'll even see the data from 2018-19 school year. It is almost certain that the rates in Butte County are going to skyrocket, you know, due to the campfire. And these were already high rates. I mean, these are already rates, you know, around 20%. So it had a tremendous effect. And you had, I don't have the percentage is perfect, but something to the effect of 2/3 or more of the students in Paradise Unified, which was hit, you know, this town of Paradise was hit hardest by the fire. 2/3 of the students lost their homes. So when you're going to have that level of loss, it's of course affecting the absenteeism rates. And a lot of these students have left the county and might not ever come back. The good news, the flip side, I guess, the silver lining to this is that it really, you know, the whole world was looking at Paradise, and it a lot of resources, a lot of mental health resources have flown, you know, have streamed into the county to address the trauma from the Paradise fire. And of course, there was a lot of existing trauma. So there's a lot of hope in the area that people will see the existing trauma, and these resources won't go away, and there'll be more robust mental health, more robust resources and avenues to reach some of these families.
We've been talking about Butte County because that's where you focused your reporting, but here in the Central Valley, I know there are some school districts in really rural areas up in foothills, just between urban communities. Can you tell us a little bit about how rates of absenteeism here where I am stack up?
Yes, the Central Valley, and it's interesting, the rates are not as bad as they are in places like Butte County and the Sierras and some of the northern coastal counties, but a lot of the counties are over the state average. Fresno's is over the state average. Kern, Kings County Kings County is actually right below the state average. Madera County, Merced County. So you have, it's certainly an issue in the Central Valley, and you have rates in many of these counties that are above the state average. And I must say that the state average is not very good. I mean, the dashboard, or the school dashboard, which is essentially the statewide school report card, says that any rate of absenteeism over 10% is considered high, and the state average is 11. So on average, the state has high absenteeism, and then places like Fresno, Madera, Merced counties are approaching 13%. So not as high as the Sierras or some of the other places, but definitely higher than average and definitely an issue.
Okay. We've been speaking to David Washburn. He reported a two-part series on chronic absenteeism in rural communities. That series was supported by the USC Center for Health Journalism's Data Fellowship, the California Endowment, and the Education Writers Association Reporting Fellowship. David, thank you so much for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you.
This past Wednesday, local environmental groups hosted a bus tour like no other. The theme was environmental justice, and it involved stops in unincorporated communities like Matheny Tract and East Arosi, where residents have been struggling to access clean drinking water and reduce exposure to harmful pesticides. The tour attracted more than a dozen regulators and bureaucrats from Tulare County and Sacramento, including Jared Blumenfeld, Secretary of the California EPA. FM89's Carrie Klein caught up with Blumenfeld on the bus.
The environmental justice movement has evolved significantly in the last 15 years. I probably have been on maybe 25, 30 tours, and I always love them because you get to see the issues from the perspectives of the people on the ground. And I think we lost some of that in the environmental movement. I mean, if you think about the 1960s that led to the kind of modern environmental era, it was engagement by everyday people. And then we kind of seeded that. Some of it went to environmental regulators and large environmental groups. And what you see in the valley, especially in the San Joaquin Valley here, is just people are affected every single day by the environment and are kind of sick and tired of not being listened to. And they, have become lawyers, they've become doctors, they've become increasingly engaged in advocacy. And so to watch that evolution of empowerment is really great, because if you think about our country, you can really determine health outcomes and environmental consequences by people's zip code. So some zip codes have a life expectancy of that you'd expect in Scandinavia, and others have the life expectancy that you'd see in Afghanistan. And we kind of at ground zero right here of people that have been given a raw deal because they didn't have the political power and leverage. So when a water system was being built, they were like, should we send it out to this small community of East Arosi? No. we've not really heard from them. They don't have any political clout. And so seeing that change is really empowering. And these tours are awesome. Like, what better way to understand the issues that people face than being on a bus?
And is the environmental justice movement, especially like having this kind of interactive tour, is this unique to California or to this part of the state? Or is this really kind of a common thing throughout the country?
So environmental groups in California, I think, in many cases are slightly ahead of the curve in that they've been really well organized. There's, you know, a lot of commonality of interest. They work together, they advocate together, and they've gained power together. And I think it's forced regulators, legislators, and others to the table. So you might have a tour like this in Louisiana or Texas or, you know, other environmental justice impacted communities. You're unlikely to have the ag commissioner that we have here, or, you know, the local board of supervisor member, or a state regulator. And so it's the ability to have an inclusive discussion where it isn't us versus them, but everyone trying to solve the problems together.
Right, and I think that's actually very palpable here, that everyone is getting along, which you don't always see. I mean, is this a good opportunity for a discussion and for learning? You know, what do you get out of a trip like this?
Too many times, environmental regulators just sit in their offices and they don't get a sense of what's happening. So I'm really fascinated to learn firsthand what are the issues. We in California often pat ourselves on the back and I think have a reputation of being very green, and by and large that's true, but there's huge swaths of the state that have been left behind, and this governor in particular lobbied on a campaign of inclusiveness of a California for all. And a California for all means that your air quality in Santa Monica should be the same as it is in Arvin or Fresno or somewhere else. And that isn't true. We have great disparity. So while we do have really forward-looking policies, a lot of people have been left behind, continue to feel left behind. And so there are difficult discussions that, you know, we all understand that our goal is to make sure that the folks with the least amount of resources have a dignity and an ability to live in California in the same way that the most wealthy Californians are living. And that really comes to air, water, and land quality. And right here, you know, most people around America, and I'm sure around the rest of the world, would not think that California has by far the worst air quality in the nation, without a doubt. And that more than 10,000 people die a year prematurely just from PM2.5, that very fine air pollution, particulate matter. So we've got a lot of problems. We need to roll up our sleeves, and this bus tour helps us do that.
And of course, even though this is an opportunity for you all to kind of be on the same page and have those discussions, there is still a bit of an us versus them, and a lot of the conversations that were happening are very much putting, you know, the onus on regulators and Sacramento bureaucrats to do something about a lot of what we're seeing. What are the next steps for you and the folks at Cal EPA, you know, after something like this? What's the follow-through?
First of all, you know, I welcome the accountability, and that is a difference between the federal government and state government, is that the people, our constituents, Californians, are right there. They have our phone number. We sit on a bus with them. It's really hard to do that at the federal government level. And so, you know, as we leave the bus tour and go back to Sacramento, we have a to-do list. The last one from Issa Rossi with Rossi, how we force consolidation, how we think about our role at the State Water Board as an administrator. We were really thankful that 2 days ago, this bill that really gives meaning to the human right to water and provides for safe and affordable drinking water for all Californians was passed. So we will have $130 million after the governor signs it to start doing the work and prioritizing it. And that really is a big opportunity for things like economic development. You know, if we're spending $130 million a year in this community and others, we need to make sure that local people benefit from it. we need to look at new technologies. No one would be building for these rural communities a small gas-fired power plant. They put solar panels on every roof, and yet we're still looking at old technology. So as we go back to Sacramento, this is impactful. It helps us reprioritize and understand the real complexity that we exist in when it comes to environmental regulations. And our job, I think, is to make it a little easier, a little more transparent for people to engage with us and get the solutions that have been way too long in the making.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of the environmental groups and advocates, you know, many of whom are here, many of them who are you know, still out there in the community right now, I mean, they are skeptical that there will be a follow-through after this. I mean, especially because I think it didn't escape the notice of at least some people that, you know, you were on your phone for at least part of the tour today, you know, either on the bus or when some of the other people were speaking. So how do you kind of assure them, or what do you do to demonstrate that, you know, this is going to have an impact?
So, yeah, it's super important to have that follow through. And I think what you see, so it's not just me on the bus. There's probably 10 staff from our agencies. And the goal is really to have a dialogue and a relationship with the community, and for them to know who to call when something happens. And sometimes that's a local supervisor who's on the bus with us. Sometimes that's me. But really, it's about setting milestones and a pathway to getting things done. And I think the state actually does have, you know, in the last administration with Jerry Brown, and this administration, all the way back to the Schwarzenegger administration, there has been an increased receptivity and relationship between environmental justice communities and the state. And we have a long way to go. And we are committed to understanding where to go based on how the community wants to help design that path together.
Great. Well, Jared Blumenfeld, Director of California EPA, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. Measure P, an effort to raise Fresno's sales tax to support city parks, was rejected by voters in November. But supporters of the measure are undeterred and now are finding new sources of revenue to bring added green space to the city. Moderator Kathleen Schock spoke with three organizers at the center of the movement: Sandra Celadon, president and CEO of Fresno Building Healthy Communities; Kyle Lopez-Schmidt, who is leading the effort to build Broadway Park in the Tower District; and Sherela Nicholson, executive director of the St. Rest Community Economic Development Corporation.
Okay, Sandra, I'd like to start with you. As the president and CEO of Fresno Building Healthy Communities, I'm curious where green space fits into the larger mission of your organization. Where do you draw the connection between parks and health?
Well, it's really interesting that you actually ask that question, because the way that I always answer it is that parks are actually the nucleus of a healthy neighborhood. So when we started this work way back when, right, it was young people and community members who said to us, what about parks? And as we started this conversation about parks, we understood, and we know now through research, that parks actually are a huge indicator of community health. We know that 80% of an individual's health is actually dependent on social determinants of health, where they live, where they work, where they play, right, where they worship. And so what we know is that parks actually dictate the health of a community within a 5-mile radius. Why is that? Because we know that people who live near a quality park are more likely to engage in physical activity. And so it's really about that holistic whole. A community that has a quality park sees a reduction in crime. Why? Because people feel invested in, because you're making those connections, you know who your neighbors are, and you're invested in the success of each other.
And it's interesting that you say that, because, and I'm going to come back to Measure P, which you were a big proponent of. You know, people who were in opposition of that measure cited safety as a major concern, but you're arguing in
Well, and that's because you have to look at safety beyond the word, right? And so that's part of what Parks really does, right? When we're talking about safety, we're not just talking about more police, more enforcement. We're talking about prevention. We know that young folks who have an opportunity to engage in recreational activities and after-school programming are less likely to then have free time to engage in other not-so-productive activities. And so it's actually a natural crime reduction technique to have quality parks with robust recreational programming. We also know that it's about getting people outside, eyes on the street, which is a natural contributor to safety. We also know that safety is actually about the built environment. People have to feel safe. And in order to feel safe, you have to have a community that reflects that land use, right? It reflects the fact that it's invested in, that it's cared for, that people belong there. And so it's really about looking at this really comprehensive definition of safety.
So Sharila, I want to shift gears and talk to you about the St. Rest Baptist Church project, which I understand broke ground just last month. Tell us a little bit about your involvement and what that project is.
St. Rest Community Economic Development Corporation is the nonprofit arm for St. Rest Baptist Church. So I serve as their executive director. And St. Rest has owned the land for 40 years. And so we've just been like really pushing to say like, all right, the land is here. We need to develop it because that's the responsible thing to do.
And where is this church located, just to give folks a sense of what we're talking about geographically?
On Reverend Chester and Riggins and Elm Avenue, so southwest Fresno.
Great.
Really, when the community has been coming together, as Sandra mentioned, and young people have said, hey, we need things to do. And when I moved into the neighborhood, I live walking distance from St. Rest Baptist Church. I just remember, I grew up in Inglewood, but I've been in Fresno 16 years now. And as Sandra mentioned, I remember not being able to go to summer camp, but there was always park activities, the Boys and Girls Club. There was always something to do at the local park where I was there every day. You know, my mom couldn't afford babysitter, so I went to the park and waited for her until she got off work. And so in our community, the neighborhood that I live in, it's kind of tough. I mean, you see kids kind of wandering. I mean, they kind of even hang out where the vacant space is, where the park will be built. Just a few weeks ago, we broke ground on the first phase of our green space park and youth facility building. And so the space is going to, it's going to be an open play. It's going to be, it's there. We're going to use it to address those public health needs and disparities, some of which Sandra had already mentioned. When you're even looking at the mental health issues in the neighborhood, or even like the high stress indicators for Southwest Fresno, or even the rate that someone lives, it's like 20 years shorter in Southwest Fresno than someone who lives in Northwest Fresno.
Because of those environmental factors that Sandra was talking about, right?
Absolutely. And so when you just have a space for people just to come walk to, just to get out the house and be able to walk and sit down and read a book or play. I mean, that's what the space is going to be used for. So that's what we broke ground on last month. We're super excited. It'll be here in the fall.
That's great. And I'm sure the community is very excited to see that.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. We are discussing the community efforts to bring more green space into the Central Valley. And I want to switch gears and bring Kyle into this conversation. You were also a big advocate for Measure P, mm-hmm. And now are working to create a park in the Tower District in Fresno. Tell us about this project.
Yeah, so I think a lot of this comes together in both being inspired by the other women at this table. Sandra and Sharila are both doing excellent work on park organizing. So being inspired by that and wanting to do something in the neighborhood where I grew up in the South Tower District, which has a very low access to parks. You know, we are targeting having like 3 acres per 1,000 residents in Fresno. The neighborhood I grew up in has 0.4 acres per 1,000 residents. So it's a pretty drastic lack of access. And this comes in a lot of our older neighborhoods where things have been built out and there just has never been planned for a way of creating more parks in the neighborhood. So there's this opportunity that came up with an old police substation that was decommissioned and torn down. That's 2/3 of an acre that looked like a really great opportunity site to pull the community together around, advocating for a park space there. And so that's what we've been doing for the last about 2 years since that police station was torn down. And again, being inspired by other community projects happening and really seeing what Sandra had said about the built environment and the potential for that changing people's lives. A lot of my experience is in architecture and community development financing, so I've got tools to affect that, and trying to work with other community members on getting those tools into our neighborhoods to making those big impacts.
And you've been holding meetings to bring the community in on this project and have another one coming up, I understand.
Yeah, we have one more on July 13th, 10 a.m. at the Review back room is our final community design meeting of selecting an alternative that we'll be submitting to the state for Prop 68 funding.
So I'm glad you brought up Prop 68 because that was going to be my next question. So talk to us, and Sandra, maybe I'll bring you back into the conversation about Prop 68. What is it and how is it helping to support this movement of community activists advocating for parks?
Yeah, so we're actually really excited that Prop 68 was approved by voters last year. Fresno Building Healthy Communities was the Central Valley lead organization. We're actually on the executive committee for its implementation. And part of why we got involved is really very much the story of why we do anything, right? We had been hearing from community members time and time again about the need to invest in parks. We know now that 80% of the parks in the city of Fresno are considered in very poor or fair status. That's the lowest rank that we provide based on the Parks Master Plan. That means that we need to seriously invest in 8 out of 10 parks in our city in order to meet health and safety standards. So our parks are not safe structurally. And so with Prop 68, it really is a continuation of the original Prop 84, which is a bond measure. It's a statewide bond measure that creates millions of dollars available. It's actually the largest in not just the state, but in the country that provides dollars, not just for new parks, but also to renovate existing parks in areas that need it most, along with other natural resource funding. And so we're really interested in the parks portion of Prop 68. And so we took it upon ourselves last year to launch technical assistance workshops to just spread the word to as many people as we possibly could and invite folks to apply. Because one of the really neat things about Prop 68, it's that nonprofit and community groups are actually eligible to apply for projects as well. This is a game changer, right? As we are seeing in Fresno, we're no longer relying on just government agencies to do the right thing. We're taking it into our own hands. And that was really what Prop 68 was about. It was a providing a vehicle for community groups to bring parks into areas that need it most. And so this is the first round of funding available specifically to renovate parks. There will be additional rounds. So if folks are working with a community group, if you are looking at a site that you thought, man, I'm going to miss the application period, which is due August 5th of this year, there's a second and a third round that will be coming our way. So I definitely encourage folks to visit the California Parks website, the State of California Parks website, and sign up for Prop 68 notifications, because this is a really great opportunity not only to develop parks, but there's also an opportunity to increase programming. So there's a lot of opportunity here for Fresnans, and so we're really excited to be working with Kyle on projects such as Broadway. We're helping other folks. We're actually hosting a couple of meetings at Cowell Park to wrap up that renovation plan, and there will be submitting an application as well. We know that our friends over at CIVCEDA, the Southeast Fresno Economic Development Association, is leading the planning efforts around the 49-acre site along Peach and Church. So we're really excited about all of these different projects that are being led and informed by community. That's the best way to ensure that community gets what they need and they want.
That's great. Kyle, why is it so critical that these efforts are grassroots in nature, that they are coming from the community? Do you think that that's going to have a longer term impact in terms of the way or the expectations that community members have of the neighborhoods that they live in?
Yeah, I like to believe in like a community design process where if people are involved in deciding what comes into their neighborhood, if they're, you know, authentically engaged in the process, then they then have ownership over that space and they feel a long-term commitment to maintaining it. They're bringing other people into that space and wanting to make sure that it's, you know, a long-term asset for the community. So that's really the key in that design process. Not only do you end up with a better product of like a better, well-designed park, but you have neighborhood engagement in it. That's really crucial for its long-term, you know, even stepping in as maintenance and making, being those extra hands and eyes on the park to supplement what the city is able to do with park maintenance, which is not able to get to every park in our city and not able to get to the depth of maintenance work that we need. Right. So,
which we know is a problem with existing parks already. Yeah. What are some of the obstacles that you have encountered so far that you anticipate you may encounter as you move forward?
There's interesting challenges related to surplus land in the city and what gets prioritized. So our existing lot has been talked about being sold to a developer for housing, and we obviously have a housing crisis. But our argument has been, let's not build more housing in a neighborhood that already lacks amenities before we improve the quality of amenities so that that housing isn't going to detrimentally impact the neighborhood, and look for other opportunity sites for housing, not just the, you know, surplus city land that could be used for parks as well. So that's one hurdle that we've encountered. Timing is always an issue. I've been working for this project for about 2 years, and this grant opportunity came up, so we're jumping on it and really accelerated to get in on time. And that feeling that we have like one shot of, you know, are we given the opportunity by the city to apply this one time, or if we don't get it this first time, are we going to be able to apply next year?
The clock is ticking. Absolutely.
That stress, yeah.
Sharmila, you've gotten over the biggest hurdle. You've broken ground. You've raised embarking on a $1.4 million project. What were the biggest obstacles that you encountered along the way?
You know, I think some of the biggest obstacles was that there has not been a project in this area in a long time, and that there just has not been a lot of investment. So it was a very new thing, and just a lot of advocacy work to say, hey, this is a need. This is the greatest need in this area. We have an opportunity to come together with partners. Would you like to join us? And, you know, most of the time it was a yes. But oftentimes, folks, there was a little bit of fear, like, is this really going to happen? Is it really going to get off the ground? West Fresno has had so many broken promises. They said that we were going to get things. It's never happened. So from the community members, it was like, well, we're going to really wait and see.
Cautiously optimistic.
Absolutely. And you
are a resident of the community.
Yes.
You know, I think about summer in particular. Where are the spaces where young people go currently during the summer months when they're not engaged in school?
Some of the schools have summer school, but, you know, if students don't want to engage in that or they don't need to go, then it's sometimes they're just kind of hanging out. There is West Fresno Family Resource Center, who they are doing great work with the Sweet Potato Project. There's also Fresno Police Department just started, I think last summer, re-engaging once a week at Fink White Park, doing like some basketball programming.
But there definitely is a void that this center will be filling in the community.
Absolutely, because not all of those spaces are walkable for some kids. And oftentimes when parents are at work and from 8 to 5 and students need somewhere to go during that time, and to be able to just walk somewhere in their neighborhood, this is the space that we're going to be able to have. So we're going to have space for 3 classrooms. So, I mean, there's arts and activities, computer lab, and then also the outdoor space that will be available, and then programming there too. So this space is certainly filling a huge void in our community. And it's been great to see all of the partnerships come together to bring this project to life.
Great. Well, thank you all for being here. We really appreciate hearing about all the exciting projects that are currently underway or in the future. So thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now for the weekend. Some people take road trips on their days off, and some people take to the air. Pilots flying their private planes from one city airport to another, maybe to log some hours or just get a great view of the Sierra Nevada. And if they're lucky, there's an airport cafe where they can grab a bite to eat. I spoke with Charlotte Scott, the owner of the Runway Cafe at the Woodlake Airport, about an hour southeast of Fresno. She says people used to fly there for the $100 burger.
They called it the $100 burger because they would have $100 in fuel they would spend when they would have to fly to come eat a burger.
That is great. So tell me, do lots of people fly into the cafe?
We have pictures of people standing next to their airplanes in my restaurant, and it's all of the clients that come in and fly their airplanes in. They're personalized pictures of each pilot that flies in because they have to have 100 hours a year to keep their license active. They just choose different airports, and they fly in, and they come to eat. We all have a good rapport. They love coming to the runway, but they fly in, and then everybody, it's so crowded there that everybody makes over the airplane. And every fourth Saturday of every month, there's an open hangar show. Everybody pulls their airplanes out, and then there's car shows and different things like that. And the pilots fly in. They fly in just because they like the food, and they fly in just because...
What kind of food do you serve?
We serve American food. We serve breakfast and lunch from 6:30 to 2 every day. Our gravy is homemade from scratch. We have specials that we run every day. Our portions, we are known for our portions at a very reasonable price.
Do you know of other airports in the San Joaquin Valley where people can fly in and have a meal?
Fresno has one, Reedley, Porterville.
And on the weekends, do people come out to the cafe and sit on the porch and just watch the flights come in?
They come out to eat breakfast and to hopefully catch planes coming and going, yes. And it's very exciting for the kids. And then once a year, the pilots there offer free, it's the EAA, they offer free airplane rides to the kids.
Oh, when is
that? And that's a big event. That is in May of every year. It's usually the first or second Saturday.
And are these local pilots or just pilots who fly in?
Local pilots, and then some pilots fly in to help.
Well, thank you so much, Charlotte, for talking to me.
Thank you. You're welcome.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook.
Don't forget to check out our app. It's called KVPR, and it's available for free on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by the KVPR news team, Alice Daniel, Monica Velez,
Carrie Klein, and Laura Satsui. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Laura Satsui. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need. On the web at chcf.org.